Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Every December, clinical and laboratory breast cancer scientists make the distant sojourn to San Antonio, Texas, to report and discuss the most important new data sets in the field, and the recent 29th annual meeting, as always, produced tons of fascinating findings. And during the conference, I met with Dr. Frankie Holmes, Dr. Terry Mamounis, and Dr. Andrew Seidman for their takes on these new data sets. To begin, I chatted with Dr. Holmes, who presented an interesting poster looking at translational breast cancer research in her U.S. oncology group.
The trial that we've just completed and is a lead on to our next trial is a preoperative, a neoadjuvant study of FEC-5FU epirubicin cytoxan times 4, standard 3-weekly cycle, followed by Taxotere and capecitabine. And this was a community-based study, but the key thing that we did is that we got tissue. And in a community practice, that was a big step for us. U.S. Oncology is a terrific organization, lots of docs, and a lot of people like me who are academic refugees who are really committed to not just treating breast cancer, but to, what are they saying in the Congress? You know, the forward, moving forward. And so we obtained tissue, core biopsies, one poster of which we'll be submitting for in vitro chemosensitivity testing, but also we collaborated with MD Anderson, and we sent our tissue to MD Anderson, Dr. Lajos Pusztai, and we are looking at the microarrays to determine, to look for signatures and denoting responsiveness. And we'll correlate the patient's response, pathologic complete response was the primary objective of this study, with the tissue microarray. So that was a really big deal for our network to get in, because to get IRB approval for this sort of thing, it has to be done in the outpatient setting. And it's very easy to send your patient in, ultrasound-guided biopsy. No, what you have to do is to recruit your surgeons, and then you have to show them this is the technique. I mean, it's not any big deal that they haven't done a million times if they're busy breast cancer surgeons. There's 4 different trays. You got to put your specimen in each vial with special preservative. And so, I mean, this was a huge thing for us. And one of the things that is reflected in our abstract is the learning curve. Interestingly, it was a learning curve not just for us, but also for the center at MD Anderson receiving all of this material. I mean, they were blown away. We had 195 samples that we shipped to them. But again, because tumors are not all tumors and they're stroma, so we had in the latter half about a 65% recovery of good tissue that they could use. In the beginning, it wasn't quite as good, but it was both sides. We had our learning curves. But what we proved is that in the community, we can do this. And so our next trial is going to be in HER2-positive patients, where we're going to be looking at lapatinib. And again, the key things are continuing to develop this approach towards personalized medicine. So the first 2 weeks of this study will be a run-in period where we'll give either trastuzumab or lapatinib, or trastuzumab plus lapatinib. And we'll get a biopsy as a baseline, and we'll get a biopsy at the end of 2 weeks, trying to look at what changes have occurred. Then the patients will be treated with FEC-75, the same as Dr. Buzdar showed, and then that will be followed by the paclitaxel, the 80 milligram per meter squared weekly for 12. During this entire time, they will get either of the HER2 agents to which they were randomized up front. So if they were randomized to lapatinib, they'll continue that for the duration of the chemo. The trastuzumab, they'll continue that, or the combination of the trastuzumab and the lapatinib. Then they'll undergo surgery, and the type of surgery is, again, dependent on their local practice, what is appropriate. And then the endpoint is going to be pathologic complete response. And then we hope to integrate all of that, obviously, into these tissue biomarkers. The patients who do not achieve a pathologic complete remission, we would like to get a third optional biopsy to see what's different about their tumor, and to perhaps use that as a springboard for, gee, now we've identified these aspects of your tumor, and you may be excellent for this sort of therapy. Now, the beauty of this trial is that we have a whole another set of wonderful collaborators. Dr. Jenny Chang is going to work with us because there are some intimations that lapatinib may have some very significant effects on stem cell bringing those stem cells out so that we can treat them. And also Dr. Lance Liotta, who's done wonderful work at George Mason University in characterizing the proteins, the proteomics, and especially the phosphoproteins, which may explain the escape pathways that some of these tumors are undergoing.
I thought of about 100 questions while you were talking. I've been jotting down notes like crazy. But just to begin, one of the things that I was curious about is you're saying that a lot of times the tissue kind of doesn't work. I mean, it's not assayable for the kinds of assays you want to do. What's the problem? What happens? Is it not adequately obtained, or is it degrades, or what happens?
So actually, there's multiple, you know, just like the Titanic, there's multiple things that can go wrong. We got the kits and all that stuff pretty much worked out. But the problem is the tumor is a complex mixture of stroma and cells. And one of the interesting things that Dr. Pustai's group did at MD Anderson was that they did a comparison of the type of material they obtained when they did fine needle aspirations versus core needle biopsies. And when I think about fine needle aspirations, I think about those last days in Vietnam, those pictures that we saw of those refugees clinging to the ruts of the helicopter as it went off. It was just jam-packed. And when you think about an FNA, so that needle goes in there with tremendous suction. It sucks up cells, which you get a lot higher yield of tumor cells than you do of stroma with an FNA. So you get a much better yield of tumor cells versus with an FNA, you know, it's just a core and you get whatever is around it. But nonetheless, they were able to work with both types of tissue, but the FNAs, they got a lot more pure tumor cells. However, you don't get as high a yield as if you take a core. So one of the issues is how cellular is the tumor, how much necrosis do you have, and how easy is it to get to the part? I mean, it's just a blind thing. Surgeon in the office holds tumor, puts in needle. So that was part of it. The second thing is, remember that this isn't a protocol, so the patients must have signed an informed consent. So this is a biopsy after the fact of their original biopsy. So their original biopsy has generated some hematoma and some inflammation and some swelling. So now we don't have a virgin tumor mass. We may be going into a hematoma. So we're getting a shred of the tumor and some hematoma. So it's tissue acquisition issues, number one. Secondly, there were some definite tissue processing issues. They're getting all this tissue from us, so they're freezing it and trying to do it in batches. Well, if you make a mistake in one batch, there goes a lot of your tumor. So it's like heartbreaking, oh my God, you know, when your patient's tumor. But anyways, so there were some learning curves on both sides.
That's fascinating. Now, in the HER2 study, which is up and running?
No, that was one of the meetings that I was talking about, because it has really been trying to bring everything together. And also, as the new information from lapatinib comes in, right, cardiac safety. So now we have a lot more cardiac safety. So we have a greater comfort level about using this combination.
Because what you're describing sounds like what the NSABP wants to do also. The chemo backbone, I think, might be different. But the whole concept of lapatinib versus trastuzumab versus the combination neoadjuvantly, I think they're interested in also.
Right.
That makes a lot of sense.
Right, it does. Because as we've heard more and more from the media, although many have suggested, oh, lapatinib is going to replace trastuzumab, I don't think it's going to be a replacement, because if you look at some of our most successful antibiotics, they block the pathway at two different points. You know, Bactrim, crummy two drugs, put them together, great drug. And so I think probably we'll be using these agents together. And so I think, you know, these trials are really exciting because our thinking has evolved.
Another thing about this HER2 study, neoadjuvant study, what are you going to do post-op in terms of, I guess, the next year, so to speak?
So the beauty of these studies in the community setting, although it's somewhat complex in terms of tissue acquisition, is that we adhere to standards of recognized care. So the objectives are get the tissue, give good chemo, maintain compliance with the lapatinib, which is an oral regimen, and the trastuzumab, that's easy, do surgery, and then after that, it is standard of care, which means we'll continue Herceptin for an additional 6 months with standard of care medicine and standard of care monitoring of the cardiac, et cetera.
6 months or a year?
Well, the chemotherapy will be 6 months.
Oh, so the 6 months pre-op.
Out back, 6 months will be
a
completion.
A total of a year.
Completing 1 year.
Which I think people can live with, but the well, I think now we're calling it the trial formerly known as Aphrodite. I think now it's called Alto or something because Aphrodite had been used by somebody else. They have an arm in there where I think they don't get trastuzumab, they get lapatinib, and I'm wondering whether people are going to be comfortable with that. Would you be comfortable with a trial like that?
Looking at the activity of lapatinib, I would be comfortable with that. I think the key thing about lapatinib, it's five to stay alive. It is five pills. They are 250 milligrams, and they are rather large-sized orange pills that are about the same size as a capecitabine pill, which is a large-sized tablet. And they're looking to see if it can be dissolved because there are a minority of women who cannot swallow pills. So compliance is the main issue.
You mentioned Jenny Chang, and she reported same thing, 3-week run-in period of trastuzumab, and then adding chemotherapy, she saw significant clinical partial response rates. We saw here at San Antonio the very first presentation, inflammatory breast cancer, lapatinib, 2 weeks of lapatinib. They had about, I think, 30% partial response rate. So these agents seem to work very quickly.
Yet it's the whole concept of the target. And if you can find the target, and if the target is as advertised, so that there's not some other mutation or hypomethylation or something that shields the target from your targeted agent, that's where, you know, that's what makes San Antonio so exciting is you come here. I told someone, you know, it's like Desperate Housewives. It's like Desperate Doctors. We're coming here with all these patients in the back of our mind trying to find answers for every single patient. And that's the exciting thing. As we can subdivide, personalize our medicine, we can find the targets. There's a lot of people that have targeted agents for us.
Any hunch about whether HER2 is going to turn out to be fundamentally different than other kinds of targets? I've heard people talk about the fact, well, maybe the HER2 tumors, maybe it might end up being different than other kinds of targets because they're so dependent on HER2.
I think what we've come to understand is the concept of oncogene addiction. And so there are some tumors that are highly addicted to their one central pathway that led them raw, you know, down the line of tumorigenesis. And I think HER2 represents a spectrum. One of the things that I'm very interested in finding out is the dose effect, because we know that, for example, the normal number, if I recall these correctly, we all have HER2 on our cell, about 180,000 receptors on a normal person, but in these amplified, it may be 2, 2.5, 3 million. And is there a dose effect? Everything else, it seems that way. Or is there a threshold effect? Once you're in, and it doesn't matter.
And of course, that's a common question in practice, which is there a relationship between the degree of amplification, for example, in FISH and response? My understanding is so far, maybe that's not the case.
Right. Everyone seems to suggest that, although if you ask some of the basic scientists, they'll say their gut feeling is that there is. And then secondly, as you know, they've just revised the guidelines for actually designating who is, in fact, HER2 positive, because we have that gray area at the FISH is 1.8 to 2.2. And now they're saying, go back to the IHC and look and see if you've got an IHC that is 3+. This is new from the College of American Pathologists. I haven't actually seen this, but I heard Dr. Edith Perez talk about this.
Interesting.
And at one of my protocol meetings, the GSK people said, yes, we have the new guidelines. Send them to me, please.
Another issue about this HER2 study, obviously, going back to the BUSDAR original regimen, is the question of trastuzumab and an anthracycline on board at the same time. What are your thoughts?
That regimen has really given us such hope and excitement because, as we've learned from this BCIRG trial that sort of turned everything on its head, I used to formally think of topo-2 isomerase as an anthracycline receptor. And now we know that HER2 positivity itself is like an anthracycline receptor. So it seems to me that you have a somewhat targeted agent in the anthracyclines. And then if you have the trastuzumab on board, again, you're doing a double whammy on this tumor. And, I mean, the data speak for themselves, these high response rates. The other thing that's very interesting is the whole notion of combined chemotherapy and hormone therapy. And when you look at some of the histologic studies that have been done where they look at patients getting Herceptin plus chemo versus Herceptin minus chemo, not simultaneously, then you see a greater influx of these lymphocytes, these killer cells. So somehow the combination of the two of them causes really triple whammy killing because, again, the Herceptin and being an antibody has that Fc portion that pulls in all these immunologic cells. So in our hands, we have been able to reproduce what Dr. Bustar showed. That is, if you just give four cycles with a slightly attenuated doses of the epirubicin at 75, you can get away with it. Dr. Venturini did a study also looking at FEC 75 with trastuzumab, and he found that up to four cycles, nobody got into trouble. But if you pushed it to eight, you started seeing problems.
In terms of ejection fractions?
In terms of ejection fractions.
And you said you've looked at it too?
In the study that we currently have, when Dr. Bustar's data became available, we had to stop the presses. And we wrote an amendment, if you are HER2 positive, we will give you Dr. Bustar's FEC 75 plus Herceptin. So all of those patients got the Bustar regimen, and we've not seen any cardiac toxicity.
That's interesting. So how many patients got treated that way?
I think it's approximately 20 patients.
And he's got not a whole lot of patients.
He doesn't.
I mean, 40
right.
or 50. But I guess right now, putting all this together, we're not seeing any strong signals in terms of the heart.
No, we're not seeing any strong signals in terms of the heart. And obviously, we're all very careful about the patients that we put on. Edith Perez has told us previously, you look at the age, you look at the ejection fraction. So you have to be very discriminating.
Just to track back to the original thing you started with, which is what you're presenting here, one of the issues in this study, and there are lots of studies, not just in breast, even lung cancer, you know, trying to do extra biopsies is the patient-informed consent. How do women respond to this request?
It's not just the woman. One of the major stumbling blocks in the current trial that we were talking about, which had actually a third biopsy planned before surgery for those patients with residual tumor, was their doctors. I'm not going to subject my patient to three biopsies. Well, you find that same spectrum with patients. There are many patients that say to me, doctor, do anything. I will be a guinea pig. And they say that word, which is anathema to us in clinical research, because I don't want my daughter, I don't want somebody else I know to have to go through this. I want to learn everything possible. There are women who don't care. And as an aside, I would say that we look at our patients as partners in research, and even though it's a modicum, we give them money for doing these biopsies. You know, it's a small amount, but their parking, their childcare, their whatever, we give them something to acknowledge their help in this. And yes, there are patients who don't want to do that. Well, they don't necessarily participate. But again, thinking about the small number of patients who participate in clinical trials, the 4%, I mean, in a large measure, you're getting the crusaders. But a lot reflects, I think, the investigator. The patients who come to see me mostly because their doctor knows who I am and what I'm doing. And if their doctor doesn't want them to get on a protocol or doesn't want to be involved in research, they're not going to send them to me. They'll send them to someone else.
Another trial that's really interesting, I think, in the neoadjuvant setting that's coming out is the NSABP B40 study, which has several different chemotherapeutic regimens building on docetaxel plus or minus bevacizumab. Same kind of strategies as what you're talking about, looking inside the tumor, looking at pathologic complete response. What are your thoughts about that trial?
I think these new agents that may be even more effective in small disease burden settings, bringing those up to the front is terrific. Although one has to be circumspect, as Dr. Sledge said yesterday, well, the whole premise of the angiogenic agents is that they're going to normalize blood vessels and allow delivery of chemotherapy. But if you have one lonely tumor cell sitting there, how is it going to be affected by this? On the other hand, I often think about these agents somewhat like Rapunzel in the tower. Okay, so this little lonely tumor cell doesn't really yet need blood vessels to nourish itself. It can through diffusion and other parameters, but even if it does decide to send out and grow, it's going to be blocked. Okay? So obviously, getting these new agents that may be more effective in small disease settings into the small tumor burden setting where we have big payoffs, I think that's terrific.
So let's talk about the BCRG-006 study presented by Dennis Sleeman. Can you kind of summarize what that trial looked at and what they've presented now here?
So the idea of the BCRG trial was to look at upfront treatment with trastuzumab in patients who are HER2 amplified, in patients who are either IHC 3+ or FISH amplified. So these were clearly centrally determined to be patients who had the target, and to look at whether the addition of upfront trastuzumab would reduce their relapse rate. The second strategy was, based on their understanding of mechanisms of synergy, whether a non-anthracycline regimen could be evaluated. And in particular, because of the known cardiac toxicity of the trastuzumab, could we find a regimen that would allow us to incorporate the trastuzumab even earlier from the beginning without having to wait until the completion of the anthracycline portion? So there were three arms in the study: the standard anthracycline doxorubicin cyclophosphamide regimen times 4, the quote AC times 4 every 3 weeks, followed by the docetaxel, and that was the standard arm, the standard in the community. Then the first investigational arm was the same, quote, AC, followed by the docetaxel with the trastuzumab given for a year with the standard monitoring. And then the second investigational arm was the trastuzumab, the carboplatin, and the docetaxel. And this arm used only 6 cycles of therapy, which was the standard described, and was therefore completed in a shorter time point than the 6 months. It was a 4.5-month time point and incorporated the use of trastuzumab from the get-go. So the findings at the 24-month time point were that there was a benefit to the inclusion of the trastuzumab, but the non-anthracycline-containing regimen didn't seem to do quite as well.
And that was a year ago.
Right, a year ago, as the anthracycline-based regimen, and the explanation for that was ostensibly that those patients with amplification of TOPO2, and that generated a lot of us doing TOPO2 in the community.
Just to clarify, what they said was, I guess about a third of the patients had amplification, and those patients did better if the anthracycline was on board.
Yes. At least
that's the way it looked last year.
And that's the way it looked last year. And so many of us began looking at that.
Planning. So you were actually ordering TOPO2 in your patients?
In patients that we were worried about their cardiac status, we wanted to know, did you absolutely need to have the anthracycline? Because if you're not, I'm going to give you the trastuzumab and not give you the anthracycline.
Just out of curiosity, what were you giving them? Were you giving them TCH?
I was giving them TC based on the San Antonio
data.
That
was my guess. So we're going to go back to that. So that you were giving them docetaxel cyclophosphamide trastuzumab.
Right.
Okay, we'll go back to that.
Yeah. And so then, a year later, and the great thing about a great trial is it continues to give new answers or new questions. And so now, a year later, we find, wow, there is no difference. All of the arms are equally effective if you give the trastuzumab, and whether it's the TCH or the ACTH, all of the arms are equally effective. Then you go back and look at the TOPO2 isomerase amplified group, and you find, indeed, this really is an anthracycline receptor, if you think about it, because those were the patients that really needed the anthracycline, that group. And if they got the anthracycline, they did as well as if they had gotten the Herceptin. So in a sense, we did not have a control arm that was devoid of the benefit that we hoped to find from this trial. Now, if you were TOPO2 negative, then you are not a patient who has another target. That is, you don't have an anthracycline receptor target, and you absolutely needed the trastuzumab. So the two trastuzumab-containing arms did equally well, and the arm that did not have the trastuzumab did not do as well.
So the bottom line is, does that translate into TOPO2 really isn't that helpful?
It's still an unanswered question. Some would say, well, gosh, if you're TOPO2 amplified, perhaps you could get anthracycline, have your 6 months of therapy, not 12 months of therapy, and be done with it. Well, some would say, well, gosh, you can avoid the cardiac toxicity because you don't have to give the anthracycline, and you can have a much more user-friendly regimen. I think the consensus is that most of us are not going to stop giving the trastuzumab. Many more of us will probably use more of the TCH regimen if we're worried about cardiac toxicity, but I doubt that there will be a large number of us who will not be giving trastuzumab up front to these patients because we gave them anthracycline.
Let me put it another way. For the past year, you've been ordering Topo 2 in some of these patients. Are you going to continue doing that?
No. I don't think there's a reason to do so.
It was really kind of surprising because when you saw those curves last year, I was like, okay, let's go. And then people, I remember Dan Hayes was running that session and he said, no, I think we need to wait until we get all the 3,000 patients. And lo and behold, there it was.
That's right.
I guess it was a good lesson for all of us, huh?
It's so hard, though, because remember during the initial trials of the BCIRG and all these other trials, I had a number of patients that said, yes, I want to be on that study. I want to get the trastuzumab. And they get randomized to the control arm. They quit the study. They went to another doctor who gave them upfront trastuzumab. You just don't know.
The other thing that you mentioned was the fact that now this year the TCH looks almost as good, maybe as good. Technically, I guess statistically, it's not any different than the AC docetaxel trastuzumab. When you look at it now, does it look essentially clinically the same to you?
It looks essentially clinically the same to me. It's hard to hang on that little tiny bit of numerical difference.
So you go back to your clinic in a couple of days and see 55-year-old woman, HER2-positive tumor, 4 positive nodes. What are you going to do?
Well, I will explain to her the results of the study, and then we'll have to sit down together and decide. Many patients already have preconceived notions about that. I have to tell you that it's very hard to give up anthracyclines in this situation.
I know. I see you struggling there. I guess you're still processing it.
Yes. I have been talking to some other physicians about that. I really have to process this some more, see what a sense of it is. I can tell you, however, that I am very comforted by this data in the sense that the patients of mine who were on the TCH arm of the BCIRG, honestly, it has been everything I could do to hold myself back from calling them in, getting their topo 2 and saying, listen, I'm worried about you. Maybe we need to get you some anthracyclines. Here, it's very comforting for me, for the patients that I put on the study, to know that they didn't get second-class treatment.
And you mentioned also the TC, docetaxel cyclophosphamide study, which to me is one of the most interesting things that's happened in the last few years in breast cancer. Before we kind of get into this issue of adding trastuzumab to it, can you talk a little bit about that study and how it evolved and played out?
So Dr. Steve Jones was a member of U.S. Oncology who had actually put together, believe it or not, the very first combination of doxorubicin and Cytoxan, quote-unquote, the Jones AC, which was a little bit lower dose. And thereafter, MD Anderson incorporated the anthracycline-based regimen. And when he was at U.S. Oncology, he also became very impressed with the activity of Taxotere and, based on some studies showing superiority to anthracycline, thought that this would be a reasonable combination, the docetaxel at a good dose of 75 milligram per meter squared with the same dose of cyclophosphamide, 600 milligram per meter squared, and to run a head-to-head combination with the standard AC. And again, this was a very straightforward, simple idea, embraced by the community, many of whom have concerns about the anthracycline. Also, we often put in a central line for the anthracycline. This didn't require that. So it was very promptly embraced. But at that point, of course, we had not been running these huge adjuvant trials. Again, our organization has matured like many others. And when the study took legs, we realized that if we wanted to have some statistical benefit, that it would require larger numbers. The study was amended. We had a larger number of patients, about 1,000. And finally now, we have seen there was not only a better outcome, but if we looked at every single subset, there was benefit in every single subset. Now, admittedly, these are ex facto. These were not pre-planned analyses. But again, always looking, doing the autopsy, where could we have failed patients by not giving the anthracycline? And of course, right now, one thing that comes immediately to mind is, gosh, what is the HER2 status of those patients? And
do we know that?
I think that analysis is ongoing. However, at the time that this trial was done, HER2 was not a routine parameter that we evaluated because it was in the 90s when this trial was done, 95. So I think we're looking back at that.
Of course, the key thing, or one of the key things that was looked at, and the paper was just published, was ER. And there's been this debate about ER-positive tumors, but at least in terms of the TC, that advantage over AC looked the same with ER-positive to me. Is that the way you saw
it? Yes, yes. There does not appear to be any subset that doesn't benefit.
Can you talk a little bit more about the efficacy data? I mean, to me, it looks like the disease-free survival is clearly better with the TC. Overall survival is better. I guess it wasn't statistically significant, but still, I think, relative reduction in 24% or something in that range. People have said, quote, well, this is only one study. How do you look at these efficacy data?
Well, first, we have to look at the study. Yes, it is one study, and it was a small study by adjuvant standards. However, it's not inconsistent with the data in the literature suggesting that docetaxel is superior to anthracyclines when they've run head-to-head studies in the metastatic setting. I don't have any problems with this study. It is a reasonably sized study, and the dose intensity was reasonably maintained. I think docetaxel is a very effective drug.
What are you doing right now in your own practice and in non-protocol setting in terms of choice of chemotherapy? For example, in a node-negative, node-positive patients, which regimens are you generally using?
I've started to incorporate the TC regimen much more frequently, especially in patients for whom I have concerns about chemotherapy tolerance. I must say that I have not given up on the standard AC taxane regimen for my node-positive patients.
At this regimen?
Time, standard anthracycline, doxorubicin, cyclophosphamide, the standard IV every 3 weeks times four, followed by weekly paclitaxel. That is pretty much what I use as my standard of care, unless patients are interested in dose dense, and I will use the dose dense regimen with the anthracycline Cytoxin. So I'll give the dose dense AC, but generally I'll give the weekly paclitaxel because I think that has a longer period of dose intensity, although I can't say that the dose-dense regimen in general is not an effective regimen. I guess one of the things that concerns me, obviously, about all of the adjuvant regimens, especially in some of the African-American women that I've seen, and in people who have a subclinical neuropathy, is that it's a Pyrrhic victory if we end up with these neuropathies in these patients. So one thing I like about the weekly paclitaxel is that I can keep a closer eye on their neurologic status.
It was said in the paper, in the TC paper, and Steve Jones has been saying this since he presented, that quote, TC was better tolerated. So it's hard to kind of get a feel when you look at the toxicity data for things like that. What's your own personal experience? How do patients sort of get through it compared to AC?
Well, as you know, AC is now recognized as a highly emetogenic regimen. So it's a Hescoth level 5. So people have the nausea and vomiting. They have the delayed nausea and vomiting. I can tell you, I was once on a panel and I was discussing emesis and somebody said, oh, that's just AC. Well, AC has a lot of delayed nausea and vomiting. There's a lot of hidden toxicity if you get in the shoes of a patient. There's a wonderful book that has just come out, Cancer Vixen, by a woman who is a cartoonist for The New Yorker. She's a freelance cartoonist in New York, and she told her story in cartoons. And it's the nausea and the lost, you know, like Ray Milland, lost weekend, that lost time around your chemotherapy, that's very incapacitating. So you don't get that. You don't have that burden of emesis, that burden of nausea. It's like you're pregnant, you know, go eat. That's one of the key things that you don't get. Sure, you have the alopecia. That's the main burden.
Now, you mentioned also the question or the idea of using TC with the C being cyclophosphamide with trastuzumab. Where's that heading?
Our group is looking at a trial in the adjuvant setting where we're going to compare TC versus either TAC or dose dense with trastuzumab in HER2-positive patients.
Any feeling in terms of how you think the TC with the cyclophosphamide trastuzumab will compare in terms of tolerability to TC trastuzumab with the carbo?
I think the TC with the cyclophosphamide is probably going to be a little bit easier tolerated. It's certainly easier to give. It's less complex. You don't have to calculate out the AUCs. The number of cycles is still something that we are working out. And in our plans now, we're thinking of 6 cycles of TC cyclophosphamide to have equivalence in the trials. We'll be doing TC versus TAC. We're going to really address the anthracycline question.
TC versus TAC in the HER2 negatives.
Right, in the HER2 negatives.
And then what about the HER2 positive?
And so in the HER2 positive, the question was TC versus Dostense with the standard inclusion of trastuzumab in the taxane-containing arm.
That's fascinating. Other than the Memorial pilot study of Dostense with trastuzumab, we don't have a lot of data on that yet. Our patterns of care study show that about a quarter of oncologists are using Dostense with trastuzumab, so you all want to study that compared to TC.
Right. It's out there.
Yeah, that's a great question. Another thing kind of related to this whole discussion, both HER2 positive, HER2 negative, TC, A, anthracyclines, are the data that came out at the last ASCO meeting on anthracycline cardiac toxicity. There were a couple papers presented there. There's a lot of discussion about that. What was sort of your takeaway point from that whole thing?
That we must not neglect this as a potential complication. I think this is one of the driving forces of these non-anthracycline containing regimens, especially as we have other cardiotoxic agents.
I mean, did you come away from that thinking that maybe the problem was greater than you thought it was?
In clinical practice, I don't routinely see a lot of delayed toxicity, but there is a significant minority of patients, especially patients that develop metastatic disease, they come back, and then you find that they have inadequate cardiac status so that you can treat them with other potentially cardiotoxic drugs. So I don't think it's an overwhelming problem, but again, I think there's a minority of patients that are affected, and I think fortunately most patients have enough cardiac reserve, it doesn't get them into trouble. But the whole notion of impairing someone, because our hope is that we're going to get more of these patients out to age 80. And they may need that cardiac reserve later on. You know, it's the whole story of the polio patients, the second wave of problems. No, it's no second wave of problems. You're just getting older and you're having neuronal dropout. So we want to make sure that these myocardiums are holding up later on. So if there is that minority of patients that we're affecting, we want to address that.
That was kind of my take on it. The other thing that was kind of interesting was this issue of other factors like hypertension, diabetes, and even in patients with normal ejection fractions, older patients, do we get a little bit, particularly with a non-anthracycline alternative, maybe a little bit more thinking about that just based on things like hypertension and diabetes?
I think one other issue that really does consume a large part of my visit when the patient comes in to see me is the fact that who is taking care of their overall health? Many patients, family physicians, okay, well, you know, you have breast cancer. Well, you know, I'm going to slide a little bit on your cholesterol. Who cares? And I am now more and more saying, what was your weight when you got married? And what is your weight now? The patient I saw before I left, she's 196 pounds. She was 131 when she got married. That's a terrible burden for her heart. And here I have added to that burden because I gave her an anthracycline-based regimen. I am insisting in a nice, kind way, in a supportive way, that she's got to do something about that, okay? And then, do you know what your cholesterol is? Women have to become advocates for their own health, okay? What is your glucose level? I mean, the thing is, I'm hoping that I'm going to cure these patients, and I don't want them to be experiencing a Pyrrhic victory from what I have done to them, A, and B, for them to die of a preventable disease. Come on, we've gone through this chemotherapy baloney. You've had those lost weekends. I don't want you to be dying of a heart attack when we could have prevented that.
The last thing I want to ask you about is you mentioned about the issue of neurotoxicity with the taxanes. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about nab-paclitaxel? U.S. Oncology has done some of the key work there, particularly as it relates to efficacy and neurotoxicity.
Gosh, this drug is very effective. We've used it in patients personally who've had prior taxanes, and it's a very effective drug. For patients that I can't put on protocol, I've used it in combination with bevacizumab. Very effective, very well tolerated. It is.
Although I guess we should make the caveat that that combination, I guess, really hasn't been studied.
It has not. No, it has not.
It kind of gets into this whole point of when you make these kinds of switches. So you're making them.
We are making them. We have an adjuvant trial in which we are looking at the dose-dense regimen with Avastin and the dose-dense regimen with nab-paclitaxel with bevacizumab. And the investigational arm in that trial is the dose-dense Abraxane nab-paclitaxel with the bevacizumab. And we've done a pilot study with dose-dense nab-paclitaxel showing that it is very safe, no increase in toxicity than what you would expect with the dose-dense paclitaxel.
Increase in terms of neurotoxicity?
Right.
What about this elusive thing I've been hearing about, that the neurotoxicity kind of goes away quicker than with Cremaford paclitaxel? Is that real?
And that is real. In our dose-dense trial, where we were giving the 260 milligram per meter squared every 2 weeks, I had two patients who did have some neurotoxicity, and we brought them back, checked reflexes and all, and I don't generally see reflexes return when I have loss of deep tendon reflexes with the paclitaxel, and we did see the deep tendon reflexes return on this. So I think this is a real phenomena. And the other thing that's so terrific about this drug is that you can understand why it is so based on the mechanism of action.
Right. Can you talk about that?
This is a terrific drug that I love to tell patients about because of the mechanism of action. And again, the discovery suddenly of a whole new aspect of physiology, namely that we have a system to deliver nutrients to our cells based on the delivery of albumin, which seems to be like one of these marine sponges that has all these little pores in it that carries all of these micronutrients, and that there are little trapdoors all over the endothelium that allow these particles of albumin laden with these micronutrients to go through these trapdoors. And then, because many tumor cells have on them a substance that you might think of as like flypaper, a spark is what it's called. But in my mind, it's like a flypaper that's on these tumor cells. And so it's a sticky thing to which there is an affinity for this albumin that sucks it right on there. And this albumin is now like a Tootsie Pop. The payload is inside. And when this albumin attaches to the tumor, again, it is endocytose, so it gets inside the cell. Just like sucking on your Tootsie Pop, you get to the chewy, soft center, the payload is delivered, and there you have really a targeted therapy. So, number one, you have a targeted therapy. Number two, you don't have the Cremaphore, which is the source of the reaction and for which we had to give the dexamethasone and give the long infusion time. And then thirdly, that Cremaphore, while it allowed us to dissolve basically pine bark and to get it as a soluble substance, would accumulate in the bone marrow and in the nerves, causing prolonged retention of this drug in a place that's not where we want it to be. So now we don't have the drug going to places that cause toxicity. It's preferentially diverted to the target.
How are you approaching the use of NAB in your practice off protocol right now?
Pretty much. I give NAB in preference to paclitaxel, period.
How do you deal with the cost issue?
Fortunately, most of my patients are insured, and that's not an issue because it is a standard of care.
What are your thoughts in terms of the relative anti-tumor efficacy of NAB versus paclitaxel?
It appears from the data that this is a more effective drug, and based on the mechanisms of action, I believe this data. One of the things when we look at a mammogram, and the mammographers will tell us, well, we see this spiculated lesion, and we do an ultrasound, and it comes back cyst. And the mammographer says, that's discordant, because this is a spiculated lesion, and you can't tell me this is a cyst, because you don't get that picture. So you have to say, what is concordant, what is discordant? And when I see a drug that has an effective delivery mechanism that allows me to give more drug to the lesion and not to the patient, and not only does it allow me to get more drug there, but also the doses that we can give are higher because the toxicity is less, then I believe it when I see that the response rates seem to be higher. I mean, this is concordant with the preclinical, the biologic mechanisms of action, and with what I see.
How much of an issue do you think or advantage is it to be able to avoid the pre-medications and have the shorter infusion times? There are quite a few oncologists who consider that not really a big deal. Is it a big deal to you?
It's a huge deal. I only treat patients with breast cancer. They have a life. They have kids. They have daycare. At its best, getting through the clinic is difficult. I mean, I have emergencies, so I'm backed up. Oh, darn. In the chemotherapy infusion room, there's all kinds of built-in delays to the system. And again, I would refer you to that book, Cancer Vixen, by this woman who writes in a cartoon fashion as a sophisticated cartoonist for The New Yorker, you name it. what her experiences were. I mean, we all think we know what it is to go through from the patient's standpoint, but all the delays, all the problems, oh gosh, the counts aren't up today, you have to come back later. I mean, these people have a life, and that time is very valuable. And secondly, not having to take the dexamethasone, are you kidding? How many people are hyper? They can't sleep that first night. They have to take all the steroid, take lorazepam or whatever to get them down. And then finally, we all know that patients gain weight on adjuvant chemotherapy because they apparently do not eat more. Their energy intake isn't increased, but their energy expenditure is decreased. So now we have this anabolic agent on top of that. And we know that some women are very sensitized to this. Then there's that minority of patients that get the acne from the dexamethasone. I mean, really, less is more. I think this is tremendous. And I strongly disagree with the statement that you made. Straw man argument, I'm sure, but.
Anything you want to add to what you said today?
I think I want to say that when I come to San Antonio and the first lecture met every expectation, I come here because I don't want to learn only how, as a desperate doctor, I'm going to fix up all my patients, but I want to know why. Why did my 33-year-old patient get breast cancer? Nobody else in her family has it. And then we screen everybody and find out, golly, mom has the gene. And the first lecture by Dr. Esteller talked about the epigenomic area, how we're coming to understand that people can have the same DNA. Identical twins can have the same DNA. One gets breast cancer, and the incidence of the other one getting cancer is only 30%. Why is that? And we're understanding some of the mysteries of this. And the epigenomic area, where we're understanding that there are these other modifications to the DNA that happen just because of where we are, what happens to us in our life experiences. And that helps take out some of the mystery and now give us more targets that we can go after. So I think just understanding the whole biology, the pathophysiology of breast cancer is so hopeful, because now we find targets where we were just trying to punch in the air. Now there are definite targets. We just have to switch the lenses and look at them.